and carry a message. And I think Charlie, I know Johnny, is one of those people. So right now, I'll give you Johnny here.
Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know whether to ascend after that introduction. I might just float on back to Syracuse here or something. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'd like to thank Charlie for inviting me with the extreme privilege of being allowed to participate in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I have always considered it, and I still do, and I hope till the day I die, I do consider it a privilege to be allowed to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in any capacity that I'm allowed to participate in it in. I've come to understand in my lifetime, in my short lifetime in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my very own case, that active participation in Alcoholics Anonymous is everything in the world about me standing. I found out since I've been hanging around with you that I will not actively participate in anything that I don't love. And I've come to understand since I've been hanging around you that I won't serve anything I don't love. And it's been my great privilege for 25 years and 7 months to be allowed to serve Alcoholics Anonymous in any capacity that they've asked me to serve it in. And I don't get any credit for that. What I'm going to tell you about is the first 27 or 28 years of my life. Now, I'm going to take full credit for that. I'm going to take a whole deal. I won that race, boy. I fought it and ran uphill into hurricanes. You talk about hills. Man, I ran up grain elevators. They're straight up the hill. I just... So I understand about them races, Your Honor. I'd also like to tell the sheriff that he better pray one thing, that we all don't drink at the same time. He don't have enough squad cars to check us. Matter of fact, we'd probably be driving some of his. I was sitting over there and that radio went off and I almost threw myself against the wall. I know old habits are hard to break. You know? But God, I'm glad to be here tonight fully clothed and in my right mind. And the reason I tell you that is it's for no particular reason other than the fact that the longer I stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I never want to forget that a little over 26 and a half years ago, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary. And because of the loving God, as they expressed himself through this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. Now, if I don't get anything out of this deal at all, I can live with that all the way home. It makes me feel good. I'd like to be able to stand here tonight, and I've been thinking about it all day. I'd like to be able to stand here tonight and tell you without any type of reservation whatsoever that that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. Oh, God, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find you. I'm just as sure as I'm standing here without alcohol working in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. As far back as I can ever possibly remember, I've been some type of emotional left fielder. I've always been kind of weird. Just wandering around out there in the world I didn't understand, doing weird things, thinking weird thoughts. And that used to really drive me crazy. Because the thoughts that I had in my head when I first started remembering the thoughts I had in my head were not the thoughts that I knew I was supposed to have. You see, I always knew all my life, prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wasn't supposed to think the things that I thought about the people I thought. And I knew I was never supposed to do the things that I was doing, but I was powerless not to do them. It's the most frightening thing that I know about when I think about the powerlessness I had all my lifetime. I had this tremendous wall of anger inside of me that just consumed me as far back as I could ever possibly remember. And I didn't understand it because I didn't want to be angry. I wanted to be doing something. And I had to have excuses for the reasons I did things. I always had people to point the finger at. I had a built-in excuse when I was born. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said to myself way back there somewhere, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are bad people. I don't want to be around them. No wonder I feel this way. And I kept trying to figure out how to get out of this deal. And I looked up one day, and there stood my grandmother in the kitchen. And my grandmother was a kindly old lady who lived till she was 90 years old, and she never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her life. My grandmother, I can remember, I was thinking about my grandmother today. My grandmother danced around in the kitchen with a little apron on and this little house that my grandmother and my grandfather lived in this little town. And she'd be singing songs like, "Yes, Jesus Loves Me," and she's doing all this kind of stuff. And in the other room down the hall, these people are killing one another. It's weekend. They're drunk and beating each other up and throwing each other through windows. And Grandma's singing, "Yes, Jesus Loves Me," wandering around. And I thought, maybe I'm like my grandmother. Because I didn't want to be like these other people. I wanted to be like my grandmother. My grandmother, prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, was the only decent image of anything of decency I ever had in my life prior to seeing you. I never was around anything decent prior to seeing you but my grandmother. And that was short-lived because I had some kind of an idea that I was going to go where my grandmother went and do what my grandmother did and be like my grandmother. But I wasn't like my grandmother. I was like those other people. But I'm going to try to change that thing. And one day my grandmother said she's going to take me where she went. And my grandmother went to this little place on the other side of town. I got up one Sunday morning. I'm excited about going with my grandmother. Because I didn't want to be like I was. If I go over there, I'd be different. I left these people that I felt different and strange and irritable around and hated. I went on the other side of town. I sat down with another room full of people and I felt different and strange and irritable and I hated all them too. I didn't understand it. And then I did something that I did most of my life up until including coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I sit in a church a long, long time ago. I'm different, I'm strange, and I'm irritable. I hate everything that moves in the world. I got that great big hole inside of me with the wind whistling in there, and I wait for this man in those long flowing robes to mount that rostrum and tell me why I feel that way. And I guess even more importantly than that, I wanted to tell me what to do about it. I remember him looking down where I was sitting and telling me I'm supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, "You're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters." And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. And God, I felt guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in that church a long time ago that people were going to find out I was hated when I was supposed to be loving, and I didn't know what to do about that either. Turned to walk outside the door of the church that day. My old man standing there, drunk and hungover, reached over and tapped me on the head and said, "Son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me." A lot of things in life I didn't want to be, but the old man wasn't one of them. My old man was a drunk. I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. That's a terrifying place for little children to live in. It's frightening. In the middle of the night in houses like that, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh-hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silent. Every once in a while, the old man come, got me and started kicking me around. He didn't do it to my brothers. He did it to me. And the most terrifying part of that is when the old man's out there somewhere. And he's drinking, and I know he's out there, and I know he's coming in, and I know when he comes in, I know what he's going to do. He's going to get me. And we're going to start this thing over. Night, there's times. When I'm going to bed, I got this big butcher knife. He comes tonight, I'm going to stick him, I'm saying to myself. Thank God he don't come those times. I just lay there with my thoughts. I think about my uncles who live in penitentiary. I think about my aunts who work in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I think about my old man who beats up my mother. My old mother beats up my old man. I think about, and I wonder what caused it. Somewhere way back there, it dawned upon me what the problem was. It's alcohol. They drink, and they do those things. I'm not going to drink, because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world. I'm going to have something. I'm going to do something. I'm going to be something. What do you do if you're weird? Tell you what I did. I took a drink. Wasn't any big decision on my part. I just got into my old man's bootleg hooch and took a drink of alcohol. And it was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It went down in there and just kind of tore all that madness from me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness. It stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living and installed in me some type of arrogance. It said, "Damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people. Maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here." That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'll tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol or use drugs anymore, they don't work. That's the simplest I know how to tell you. The sad part about my life is, they quit working 10 years before I knew they did. I spent the last 10 years of my life out there running around the world trying to make the answer come out of the end of a hypodermic syringe. And it didn't work. And when you get to that kind of stuff, you're just in trouble. Now, what happened to me when I drank happened to me every time I drank. There was no difference in my patterns. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath the bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol, they pulled me out of a car in Compton and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to 20 years in penitentiary. Every time I drank, that's what happened to me. I got drunk and went places. Just travel around out there. I was in that reform school in this little town of Kansas, and my mother came with a piece of paper one day and took me out of there and headed towards California. She said, we get to California, things are going to be different. They were. We left our one-room shack in Kansas. We went to California and got a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went on a street corner and got drunk. I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice at the same time. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground and having them come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated doing. It went down in there and tore all that madness from me. It took me from there and it stood me there and it gave me that. I thought maybe they had something they want me to say. I don't know. There you go. That's the story of my life. Yeah. See, if you'd have brought your wife, Mary, he could have took her too. Wherever they go. Oh, well, easy come, easy go. I can stand here before you tonight, and I know some things. I don't know about a lot of things, but I do know some things because I've been close to and active in this program at Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years and 7 months and some odd days. And all that length of time, I haven't found it necessary to put any type of chemical substance in my system. But I know some things. I know as I stand before you tonight that I don't know anything about stopping drinking. I don't know anything about that. I don't know how you stop. I don't know how you do this thing. I don't know how you put that plug in a jug and sit down in that seat and quit drinking. I don't know how you do that. I'm standing here before you tonight. It's been 25 years and some odd months since I've had a drink. And right up to this instant, I haven't quit drinking. Quit me. I have people from time to time that I work with tell me, I don't know how to quit drinking. What do you think I ought to do? I've got a perfect remedy for stopping drinking if you don't know how. You can go hit a cop in the mouth. Well, that'll get you stopped for a little while, don't you think, Sherry? I mean, stopping ain't the hard part for me. I stopped all the time. They used to restrain me. You know what I remind me of when I think of me? I think about a racehorse coming out of the starting gate on a racetrack. That's what they used to do. They used to lock me up, and I'd be all right in there for a little while. I'd play baseball. I was an athlete. I read and studied. I was a scholar. I did all that kind of stuff. But then I started thinking about showing up out there in the neighborhood. I started thinking about the gang wanting me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what the gang would say if I was telling them I don't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. What if they would say? I wonder what they would say if I was telling them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head. I want to go play baseball. I wonder what they would say. You're like me, and you're nothing. You're nothing. And you glued over there against the corner of the wall. You're trying to figure out that magic thing that frees you from there and stands you there and gives you that. You think about that. Finally, the answer comes, it's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. So that's all I ever thought about. Think about sitting down on the street corner and capping a seal on that baby and make that magic come all about me. One day I sit down on the street corner, a girl from reform school, got a gallon of wine. I drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death, my magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about that. Guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder. Why don't you try this? He gave me some pills. I found out if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. Wasn't very much longer after that on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine. Nothing was working, and a guy come along and said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things that sustained me for the next 14 years of my life. And that took me on a ride through stark raving terror and hell that I hope to God I don't ever have to go through again. Slipping and sliding and working and things. And what happened to me by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was burned up. There was nothing left of me. Nothing. I spent the last couple of 3 years of my life running around out there in my active alcoholism trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true years ago. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He said, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room. He said, it's going to end up there. And I told him, not me, I'm different. Come walking out of the institution, bound and determined, I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I'm laid in a nut house kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the country, the interviewing psychiatrist. I used to interview him. I'd sit there with my little white coat on with the long sleeves and the buckles in the back. They're very chic, them little deals. And we engaged in conversations, the doctors and I. They talked to me about my mother, and I talked to them about their mother. And they threw me out of the room. They introduced me to a thing called better living through electricity. Kind of gets the job done in a hurry, you know. I never understood. They said I had a bad attitude. That's what they said. They said I had a bad attitude. They didn't say I was an alcoholic. They just had a bad attitude. They didn't say I was an alcoholic. They just had a bad attitude, and I was corrupt, and I was evil, and I was bad, and I was filthy, and I was a thief, and I was no good, and I was this and that and the other. They said I was an alcoholic. Of course, if they'd have told me I was an alcoholic, I'd have threw something at them. You know, the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the very day I wandered into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, if they'd have set me in a room and put a lie detector test on my arm and said to me, are you an alcoholic? I'd have said no, and that needle would not have moved. Not at all. It would not have moved one thing. Because I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I pursued the illusion that I was different into the gates of insanity and death. You know the illusion that I pursued into the gates of insanity and death? The illusion that alcohol creates within a person like me. See what happened to me, the illusion that happened to me, that once upon a time, way back there somewhere, I took a drink and it did something for me. That's the difference between me and somebody that it doesn't do anything for. It did something for me. Now, it's my belief that over the next 20 years of my life that I practiced this active insanity of mine, that it never did the same thing twice in succession. And way back there in the small recesses of this thing that I call an intellect was the knowledge that once upon a time I swallowed something and it was okay. And that's the illusion I pursued into the gates of insanity and death. And for the last 14 years of my life, I was an active heroin addict. Still looking for the answer. Still looking for the answer. A little over 28 years ago, they strapped me down on a bed in the Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds and I was yellow, and there was a medical doctor standing at the foot of my bed telling me I was going to die. His story was this, son, you're going to die, nothing we can do for you. I said, okay. All day passed, and all night passed. He come wandering back in my room the next morning. He said, son, you're going to die. Nothing we can do for you. And I said, okay. The third day he wandered into my room, I had a terror grip me that I'd never known before since. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up off that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again. And God knows I didn't want to do that. I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Now, I thought for a long, long time that nothing had happened, because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts. Henry got an A meeting down there. The little bird didn't walk in and drop the fifth chapter on my chest. And I didn't wander off into the tulip somewhere. The only thing, I just went to sleep for a little while. I'll tell you how sick I was. Or insane, or whatever you want to call it. 2 weeks after I screamed out that prayer in my deathbed, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on the bed I just got my foot. I don't know what you call that. I found it. I had no trouble getting loaded. I get loaded anywhere. When I want to get loaded bad enough, I will. If that insanity and that pain of mine was so severe that I had to have something to take the edge off, I'd take it. And I'd find it because it was necessary for me to live, or else I'd blow my brains out. That's where I live. I stood in front of a Superior Court judge a long time ago, and I was sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. It didn't mean anything to me. I was a shell standing there. But he said to the lady sitting in the courtroom in his conversation, he said to her, "Lady, if you cared anything at all about the child you carried inside of you, you'd get so far away from this scum, you'd never be allowed to lay eyes on it." He said, "I was a blood-sucking parasite in society. I had no right being around decent people. It was in his power. It was never going to be." And I'm standing there thinking, he's not talking about me. That must be my old man or my uncles or my grandfather or somebody. But he was talking about me. He put into words what I spent a lifetime trying to hide from the world. What I was. In here. Not what I put up out there. But what I wasn't here. That's the thing that used to drive me crazy. The evidence of that man's statement was so damning, I spent the next 9 months of my life locked up in solitary confinement. And that's the condition I was in on the first Sunday in November 1959 when I wandered into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't take any credit for staying here from that day to this day. If I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't even have come. You know why I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? The institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous over 25 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been hawking and sniffing around here ever since. You got to be careful what gets us sick people in here. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved in and I sit down in the back row in what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big gates, and I thought to myself, my God, I wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He said, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Doo Doo's Anonymous or any kind of an, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Didn't know what one was, but I didn't want to be one. I told myself, "Well, I'll sit around and wait for these women and tell their racy story." And they got up and threw me a curve. Well, they had sort of a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face, and they sort of radiated something I didn't understand, and right away they run and start talking about God. When I came here and you talked to me about God, I got up and ran out of the room because God was the reason I was. It was not my fault. You see, when you run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions, and you're like me, you got to have something to blame. I did. I had to have something to blame. The thing that kept me from blowing my brains out was my ability to blame somebody other than me for my own actions. And when everything else fails, and you run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions, you can always blame God for it. He don't talk back. He accepts a lot of heat. You ever hear him in AA? People talk about him all the time in AA. "Well, I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club." Deal. I'll tell you how I feel about that. Next time you get hungry, you go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. When God squirts you one through the keyhole, you call me. I'll be on the next plane east. I'll tell you what I've learned about God in 25 years hanging around people like you. And this is all I know about God. I've come to understand that God will not do anything for me I can do for myself. Nothing. And you know there's one single thing that I can't do? Never been able to do, can't do it right now, will never be able to do it as long as I live. I cannot of myself keep from taking a drink. As of myself. Now, for 25 years and some odd months, I haven't put any type of a chemical substance in my system, and I ain't done it. Something obviously has happened to me. And what happened to me was my belligerence and my differences and my denial were the things that saved my life. I said in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and different than you were, but prideful in my differences. I used to be very prideful in my differences. I hear people talk about things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand. They say, I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore and everything is wonderful. I said, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. I was cold sober when those people told me that. When you told me that, I was as sober as you were. I used to hear things in Alcoholics Anonymous I didn't even understand. I hear people say, you got to get active in AA. I didn't know what active was. One day I wandered up to this AA secretary, and I said to him, I heard in that meeting the other day that you got to get active in AA. He said, that's right. I said, I'd like to know what I can do so nobody know I'm a member. He said, what? I said, I want to know what I can do in AA so nobody knows I'm a member. He says, you are sick, aren't you? I'm dead serious. Dead serious. See, I don't even know what I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what I wanted. I really don't. You said you were sober. So was I. And sober was not my ambition. I had been sober before, many times, and I didn't like being sober. Sober was when the nightmares appeared. Sober is when the faces of the people I'd harmed showed up. Sober is them rotten, filthy little nickel and dime compromises that I'd made all my life, starting to reach down inside my gut and tear me to pieces. That's what sober was. Sober was me, and I couldn't stand me on any type of a basis, and I didn't want to be sober. So when you talked to me about being sober, you'd have anything I wanted. There were some people who came to this institution. Some people, not all the people, one or two of them, who had something. I didn't know what it was. Today I know what it is. I didn't know then. But these people stuck out like sore thumbs. These people walked in peace. That's all I knew. I didn't know it then. They were just different. And I guess maybe that's what I wanted. I suppose that's what I wanted. Whatever it was they had, and I didn't know what they had, but I think that's what I wanted. But you see, what I wanted that, and I wanted to live my own lifestyle. See, I still wanted to be hip, slick, keen, and cool. I wanted to be a taker of things and a user of people. I still want to stay a loser. You know what will happen to you if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years and some months? Try to the best of your ability to practice these principles in your life one day at a time and give it to anybody that wants it. You know what happened to you? This program will de-hip you. You know why I know that? My 23-year-old daughter calls me a square. That's what she said. She said, Daddy, you're a square. I said, thank God I've made it. Damn near died out there hip. I almost died here hip. That's even sadder. I was almost too hip to make the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was almost too prideful in my difference. You know what happened to me? My differences took over. Every time I talked to one of you, you talked to me about this book. It's in the book. It's in the book. And what? Look at that book. It wasn't written by anybody. So I told them, well, I'm different. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, I told myself. I didn't tell them, I told myself. I'm going to work their program of recovery to prove to them I'm different. It won't work for me. You know, I couldn't admit that I was an alcoholic. I couldn't get it out of my mouth. It stuck there. I couldn't even admit that my life was unmanageable. I'd been a ward of the state of California for 20 years. I'd done a good job running things. It said that I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself now. There wasn't anything any greater than me. Could restore me to sanity. I think they're referring something that I was nuts or something in that step. I wasn't nuts. And I got papers from some of the finest doctors who ever wrote papers on insanity. Says I'm nutty in a fruitcake. But you know, I couldn't admit that I was insane. I didn't know what insanity was. You know what people say insanity is? They think insanity is chewing their tongue in two, laughing out the side of their mouth, or running, jumping around, flopping on the floor. You know what a guy that I sponsored told me insanity was? Made more sense than anything I ever heard. He says insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, and insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. I don't want to get too deep with you tonight, but that's just trying to take along the surface here for you. There's a guy that told me one time that the book Alcoholics Anonymous is like a big old toolbox. There's a wrench in it that fits every nut that walks in the door. And there's one that unscrewed me, and it's called A Searching and a Fearless Moral Inventory. Now, I don't recommend that to anybody who not serious. And I didn't do it because I was serious. I did it because I was different. And this thing wasn't going to work for me, and I was going to prove it now. I don't recommend that because, you see, when I started to write this inventory, I got dangerous. Because I started putting things down on paper that I ain't never told anybody before. I'm not talking about the big deal. I'm not talking about the scores and the penitentiary, the people I hooked, and the people I shot at, and the money I made, and the dope I... None of that stuff. I started putting down them little nickel and dime things that I did. Them little penny ante things where I turned and walked away with that cowardly feeling in me. Crawling underneath beds in the middle of the night, stealing piggy banks from my people so I could go out and buy some dope and tell them I was a big man and made a big score. That's the kind of stuff that started coming out of my inventory. When I got that thing pretty well into it, I was about ready to cut my throat. But there's relief there, too, for a guy with my illness. I went down and sat down with a man, spent 3.5 hours with him. I told him about me, every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And somewhere during that 3.5 hours, I heard myself admit to this man I was an alcoholic. I'd never said the word before. With the utterance of that word from down inside of me, there came a freedom within me that I carry with me today. And you know what the freedom was? I heard myself say that I was an alcoholic. I understood for the very first time in my entire lifetime what was wrong with me. I never knew. I had a disease, and it was called alcoholism. I didn't know that. I thought I was crazy. I thought I was a moral leper. I thought I was this. I didn't know what. I thought I was absolutely insane to do the thing that I did that I never wanted to do. I didn't know I had a disease called alcoholism. By the time I got to the... You know that in the third chapter of our book of experience, this thing written right here, it was written in New York, so I can't take credit for it. Didn't come from California. It says in the third chapter here that we have to admit to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. That's the first step in recovery. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? By the time I'd made the utterance of that admission to my innermost self, I had read what this book says about there is a solution. And by the time I got to the fifth step, I was faced with the sixth and seventh step. And I had to become ready to have God remove all my defective character, but I got to know about my defective character. I don't know what they all are. I got a piece of paper. Long about that time of my life, my vocabulary consisted of about 4 four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere. It's kind of like a trigger that made it all. And there was a little guy come in there one day, was sitting in a barber chair, cutting his hair, a little dentist. And he's talking to me, and I'm cussing him. He said to me, "John, if you ever get out of here, what are you going to do?" And I told him. He says, "You'll never make it." I said, "Why not?" He says, "The minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from." I said, "What's the matter with my mouth?" He says, "Nothing, you just open it every now and then." And then he said to me, he asked me, he said, "Do you know what cussing is, Johnny?" And I said, "No, what is it?" He says, "It's a crutch for conversational cripples." And I heard myself say to this man, "Oh, what am I supposed to do about it? I've always talked this way. I don't know any other way to talk." He says, "If you're serious, I'll help you." And I guess I was serious because he and three of his little friends from town, three non-alcoholic businessmen from this little town, set me in a room for a period of time, and word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, fed me the English language. Stood my wrath when they corrected me. They didn't laugh and tee-hee and think it was cute. I understand that to be love. I don't think... I've come to understand why them little men would do that. It's taken me a long time, but I think I understand it. You see, these little men could correct me because they didn't expect anything out of me. You see, they didn't have to overlook anything that I was doing because they weren't about to do anything that I would have to overlook, so they didn't have to build any good time. I've come to understand that there are people like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, who live that way along that line, who are not about to do anything, they're going to be forgiven, so they don't have to have you forgive them if they correct you. And if you got any people like that around this town, you better get real close to them because they're going to save your life. These people who overlook and, oh, well, it's quite all right. Do anything you want to do. Don't drink and come to these meetings and you'll be wonderful. Well, that may be all right if your problem is alcohol. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. And alcohol is not my problem. My problem is sobriety. It always has been. It always will be. And it'll be that way tomorrow and the day after that and as long as I live. Alcohol is my answer to sobriety. It behooves me, I suppose, to discover a way of living which doesn't make it necessary for me to have to drink anymore. I had to discover a way of life when it became more necessary for me to put something into life and to take something out of it. I had to have a place where I could go and give to life. And I've come to understand that that's what Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship is to me. It's a place that I can go and put something back into life. But if I stood or went or did every day of my life for the next 50 years, I spent trying to put back into Alcoholics Anonymous what I was given, I'd never be able to do it. I would never be able to pay the tremendous debt of gratitude that I owe you for what you showed me that I could have. And that's all you did. You showed me, by your example, what I could be if I would do what you did. That's all. And for some strange, unmysterious, unknown reason to me, I believed you. I had never believed anybody else before on the face of this earth. I hadn't believed the preacher, or the teacher, or the warden, or the counselor, or my mother, or anybody. But there was something about you. It came from your heart, and it touched my heart. You see, there's something I understand that a lot of people don't understand. And I know there's a lot of well-meaning people in the world. They don't know what it's like. And they will never understand what it's like to have a drink. To have a drink. If you've never been there, if you've never sit there with that craziness about you and you've got to have one of them things and everything inside of you says don't and you do it anyhow. If you've never experienced that, you would never understand it. You understood it. You understood what it was like to be cold sober and stone crazy. You told me it was okay. You said Alcoholics Anonymous was the only place that I've ever found. Well, you can come in here and throw an emotional upheaval. Nobody pays any attention to you. Do you know that this society that I live in called Alcoholics Anonymous is the only society that I know of on the face of this earth, anywhere, I bar nothing, that has no conditions on it? Do you know that? This is the only place that I know of that you can come in and throw up on the guy next to you. And nobody will ask you to leave. It's the only place I know of. Now, you come back next week, that guy won't sit next to you no more. They won't ask you to leave. I came out, Tuesday. It's coming Tuesday.
It'll be 24 years since he opened the door of that penitentiary and told me to go out there with them. You talk about, you know what I was doing? I just wanted to go to an AA meeting. I went home to see my mother. She fell off the step blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. Took my mother a long time to get sober. I'm proud tonight to tell you when she's sober, she goes to meetings. She don't stay sober. That isn't any of my business either. Do you know what I learned from my mother? I've learned that I do not have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. Where would I get any power? I didn't have any when I came in here. Where would I get it? You know what this book said? You know what this little book said? The book says, I got a daily reprieve. That's what this book said. I've got a daily reprieve from this thing called alcoholism contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions. Now, where would a clown like me get any spiritual condition? I didn't have any. I never had any when I got here. I never had any in my life. I don't know anything about spiritual conditions. All I ever thought about before I came here was me. I didn't think about anybody else. I hear people talk about that all the time. I hear people talk, oh, yeah, I used to believe in God before I got there. I didn't. I can't make that statement. I hear people say, I used to love my family before I came here. I can't make that statement. I loved anybody before I came here. Then I started drinking. All I ever thought about was drinking. Then I started getting arrested. And all I ever thought about was getting arrested and getting out and drinking again. That's all I ever thought about. It was a vicious circle. There was no place in my life. Now, for just periods of time, I get my eyes off of me and think about you. And I suppose that's about as spiritual as anybody ever gets. That's spiritual you get. And I hear people talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't believe a lot of things I hear. I hear people say we're chosen. I don't believe I'm chosen. I don't believe you're chosen. I don't believe I'm any more chosen than that poor guy that's laying down there in the street drunk, can't get sober. I don't believe I'm any more chosen than he is. And the reason I don't believe that is because you taught me something. You taught me that we're all God's children. All of us. You said to me, if one of us are, we all are. You also told me that the book that he talked about, that Mac talked about, says that God made the rain to fall on the just as well as the unjust. So why am I sober and that poor guy down there ain't? You taught me that I'm one of God's children. You taught me how to act like one of God's children, so he treats me like one of his kids. That's all. It's a simple thing. You taught me, and I imitated you and acted like you, and the first thing I knew, I would turn around acting like me. So what's my life like then? My life is good. Real good. The girl I was never supposed to see, she's got three of the prettiest little boys you ever saw, my grandson. I not only raised her, but she brings them kids by and lets me play with them. Ain't that something? You saw that blue-eyed woman that Charlie took off somewhere. You know, don't know where she's at. I guess sooner or later we'll get together again. Tickets say Mr. and Mrs. Harris. I got her from you 17 years ago today. Today I married her. Today is our 17th anniversary. You know, I can buy a card before I go back to the room. I just thought about that. Life is good. This program works where nothing else ever worked in my life. It's the only program in the world that works for alcoholics. It's the most successful tool for recovery from this disease of alcoholism has ever been. This thing here. It was written by a guy from New York. You guys got an edge on stuff over here. We have to wait to get a second hand out there in California. It's something. I'll tell you about my life today. I ain't tell you about my life today by telling you a story. I've got to tell you the story. Dottie told me to tell you the story. Dottie liked to hear the story. That's why she left. Everybody knows me knows I love to play golf. Boy, I love to play golf. About the only thing I do anymore besides go to meetings and work is play golf. And a few years ago, a company I worked for bought me a membership in a really exclusive country club. And I'm out there on Wednesdays playing golf with some doctors. And I got a short sleeve shirt on. And on my arms, I got things like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them. Panthers with the side shot out and little scar tissue here and there. They're real conversation pieces in the coffee shop. The little doctor said to me, he said, "Gee, Johnny, you have big forearms." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Did you ever play baseball?" I said, "Every time I went to jail." He said, "Oh, you've never been in jail." Well, I didn't tell him any different. I'm glad because I found out this little guy is a... He told me his story. He was a little Jewish orphan in the Bronx in New York, and he was in an orphanage. And he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without it. He took himself out of that orphanage. And he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without it. He took himself and put himself through school. And then he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without it, and he became a doctor. And then he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed. He saved his money, and he joined the country club, and he plays golf on Wednesdays. He spent his entire lifetime doing that. I have no way of telling him. I spent my entire lifetime running up and down the streets, in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses, and I got sober and ended up in the same place he did. And I'll tell you what I can't tell him because he don't believe me. And he don't believe me for a very good reason. Society doesn't believe it. Society says you have to work, study, and sacrifice, and do without. That's what they tell you. That's not what you told me. You told me my sobriety was a gift from God. That's what you told me. And I said to you, "Well, what do I give God back?" You said to me, "What you do with your sobriety is your gift to God." Now, I thought about that a great deal. Matter of fact, I don't think about much else. If what I do with my sobriety would be my gift back to my loving Father God, I would only pray for one thing and one thing only for as long as I lived. I would only pray that my loving Father God would be as pleased with my gift to Him today as I've been with His for 25 years. Thank you.
She came back.
She went out to buy me a card.
He said she went out to buy him a card, though. Congratulations. 17 years. Two ovations, you know. Once for his speech and once for his 17th wedding anniversary, though. I told you. What can I say?
I must now take care of it. I did. For the next 2 years, I went to work and I worked at it hard because I wanted God to love me and I wanted to be a good credit application. And I thought it out and I worked it out and I maneuvered and manipulated and figured and arranged and I did it as good as I knew how to do it. And 4 years clean and sober, approaching my fourth birthday, I went financially bankrupt through the courts. I was handling the money. They repossessed my automobile. Again, I was handling the money. I had been uncomfortably and not by desire celibate for a few months, and that was no fun at all. Okay? And I was working in a car wash for $1.25 an hour. I was handling employment. And the bummer about the car wash was I had started in soap at $1.35, but I broke out in a rash from the goddamn detergent. had to be moved to the drive-off end. So approaching 4 years of sobriety, I was flat broke, did not own an automobile, had a rash on both arms. My hemorrhoids were coming back from bouncing in and out off the hot car seats all day long. I was horny and not very happy. That's as good as I can do it. Okay? That's clean and sober with the 12 steps, right? What is the sign? Steps to what is it? Steps to the promises. Okay? I was trying to step to the promises. Unfortunately, one more time, I started in the alley. I spent my whole life in alleys. I'm always in the alley, right? Never on the boulevard where it's happening. And my head always says, no, go down the alley. You know, we're used to alleys. We're comfortable in alleys. You know, the good people walk on the boulevard. You know, you and I will go down the alley. Jeez, that's a fucking stupid alley. I can't see straight. Anyhow, an Eskimo drove through the car wash and offered me another job. After a year on this job, I broke my back. I surrounded. Okay. Don't lose my head. My head is running out of time here. I was approaching my fifth birthday in alcoholics. Screw it. See, I was thoroughly convinced. I kept looking around AA, and I became convinced that there was a secret here. Okay? That there was either a coded message hidden in the big book, or another step, or a secret goddamn meeting, or a piece of literature that you had to know the right person to get. But there was something going on, and I was 5 years, 4 years on the program, and I couldn't find it. You know? Because people felt better than I did. You know? And they had more peace of mind than I had. And they had less sobriety than I had. I mean, you know, when I was broke on my ass in the car wash, man, I was borrowed $300-$400 from my baby, for Christ's sake. You know, I mean, I was not what you would call an example of successful recovery, you know. My babies are coming to pick their sponsor up, take him to the meeting, because he ain't got a car, right? You know. But anyhow, I worked on this job as a die catcher for almost a year, and I went back to a convention in Denver, Colorado, and I was there a week, and I had a great time and got ready to leave this damn convention. We pulled out. See, I believe in Eskimos and the power of God, and I'm there. Screw it. I'll slow down and tell this man, because I have almost died in sobriety. I've had just immense pain. I was trying to fix me so that I would be good enough for God instead of letting God take care of me. I'm back in Colorado. We leave this clubhouse there, and after the convention, and we're in brand new Dodge, and we turn the corner, and the tie rod snaps. Brand new Dodge, okay? Guy had taken it to the gas station to have a tire with a bubble that had changed, and the Eskimo at the gas station had dropped it off the jack, and it had bent the tie rod. The tie rod broke. We pulled over the curb, park. Man and his wife pulling right behind us, okay? Eskimo, alright? They'd been at the convention. Kind of guy I hated in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I'd gotten clean and sober with 3,000 of them in Pasadena. Charlie Snowshoes, you know? Guy, never drank that much, you know, never got that bad. One day they passed out in the boardroom in their corporation. It was embarrassing. They came to AA and got sober. Their lives were in better shape. Drunk than mine was sober, you know? Had no communication with them at all. Figured they wouldn't know emotional pain if it ran them down in the middle of the street, you know? Drinking was their problem, okay? And I look at this guy, he's about 43 years of age, prematurely gray, lovely wife sitting next to him, their 3-year-old baby daughter. And I said, oh, God, Charlie Snowshoes, right? The car is about to go to hell. You know, I mean, Eskimo is an Eskimo, all right? Can't be too sick here. We couldn't get the car fixed that day because it was new. It had to be repaired under warranty. Now, listen very carefully to what this man said to us, because it's the basis of spiritual principles. The basis of spiritual principles. One my head hates, absolutely hates. He said, look, okay, you guys can't get your car fixed. We'll take the six of you, those six of us, three guys, three of us. We'll take you all out to our house, put you up for the night, and we'll pack your lunch tomorrow and put you on the road back to California when your car is repaired. He's taking his brothers and sisters off the street, and he's going to house them and feed them. It's the basis of spiritual principle, okay? He got the car towed in, took the girls out to the house, came back, got up, we get out in the southeast end, we pull into this massive circular drive in front of this big brick house, another new car in the driveway, and I'm moving in Charlie Snowshoes, right? Walk through the house, the spiritual frame of mind, press the furniture to the best of my ability. It was all terribly expensive, you know. I figured, oh, well, what the hell, right? And that night, we're all sitting around this giant oak table in the kitchen, eight of us having coffee, and the man looked at me and said, I was really glad to hear you talk about drugs at the convention. I thought, what in the hell does Charlie Snowshoes and Denver Conrad want to know about those? This is 1967, you know. Jesus. So I looked at him and said, why? And he looked over his wife and he smiled a marvelous, gentle, very spiritual smile. He said, well, he said, Mother really doesn't like me to talk about this a lot. He said, but I'm a three-time loser for drug addiction from California. Charlie Snowshoes, my first judgments are always good, you know. He said, and I went to AA in Quentin, and I went to AA in Folsom. He said, but it didn't take, man. He said, I came to Denver 2 days over 4 years ago, and I was 2 days clean. He said, I walked into the clubhouse in downtown Denver, which is a skid row clubhouse. He said, Mother here was working behind the counter serving food. He said, I remember what the people in AA had said about it. You want what we have, and we're going to go to any lengths to get it. And I wondered what that lady had, and I knew that with her, I would be able to stay clean and stay sober. That doesn't sound like don't get emotionally involved, does it? I look at him, man, and my mind starts working like a computer. You know, his jacket is worse than mine, for Christ's sake. I've got more time on the program than he has. I know he ain't got the job, right? He can't have the money. She can't have the money because she's working in Skid Row Clubhouse. I now know I have finally found the son of a bitch who's going to tell me what the secret is. He can't be living the way he's living, man, without stealing or knowing the secret. All right? And I looked at him and I said, okay, I said, look, I said, I know we both belong to the same fellowship and we both try and practice the same 12 principles in our life on a daily basis. I said, well, would you mind explaining all of this to me? And he looked at his wife and he smiled the same beautiful smile one more time. He said, Mother and I go to a lot of meetings and we take the third step every morning. I was almost 5 years clean and sober. Almost 5 years clean and sober. Okay. Heavy into AA activity, okay? I had never said no to an AA request because I was raised that way in AA. I had traveled 40,000 goddamn miles a year in institutions, okay? I had helped newcomers that I hated, okay? Got out of bed when I didn't want to get out of bed. I used to make coffee and think about putting ready in it. I hated it. I had done all these things for 5 years, and for the first time I heard the third step of AA. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Period. Doesn't say minus girlfriends, it doesn't say minus employment, it doesn't say minus money, it doesn't say minus anything. It said made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, period. I came back to California and I went back to my little apartment and I went to my job one day and I came home that night and I sat down in my bed and one of the things that had been driving me crazy in Alcoholics Anonymous is I knew that if I could ever find the right prayer, God would understand me. If I could just get to be a good enough human being and I could find the right words with which to pray, then maybe He'd do for me what He was doing for the rest of you in AA. Because you weren't showing me your pain, so I didn't know you were hurting me. And I sat on my bed that night, almost 5 years sober, in absolute total desperation. I looked at the ceiling in my apartment and I screamed at the top of my lungs. I said, if you're not there, I am fucked. I could change the prayer for those of you who are sensitive, but it would diminish it a lot, yeah? I knew if there was no God, I was going to have to die because I'd worked this program as good as I knew how to work it, and I had given it every ounce of energy. I knew how to give it, and I had done as good as I could on the job, and I had done as good as I could paying bills, and I had done as good as I could in relationships. I had done it as good as I could do it, and I didn't know how to do it any better. I went to work the next day. I placed a brand new Allen head wrench into a brand new Allen head bolt, slipped. I went backwards against one of the furnaces and crushed 2 vertebrae in my back. Short time later, I'm laying in the emergency hospital, and the doctors are saying to me, okay, you can't stand for long periods of time. You can't lift anything heavy because my back has been broken a number of times. With my attitude, it was easy to get it broken. Anyway. And I'm laying there in the hospital, and all the doctors leave me in this little cubicle, and they walk out, and my head starts screaming. You goddamn dummy, you surrendered to God last night, and you broke your back. Okay? But I was tired, man. I was tired. I was tired of making judgments. I was tired of interpreting. I was tired of figuring. And another little voice from down in here said, why don't you shut up? I thought, God, I think I will. You know, I'm really tired. I'm really tired. You want to ask me how I tell God's will? It depends on where the voice comes from. If it comes from up here, I try and ignore it. If it comes from down here, I listen. I swear to God, I listen. Anyway, I went about doing the things I was supposed to do. I decided it wasn't a bad deal. I filed for vocational rehabilitation, disability insurance, etc., etc., etc. I had to go through all the bureaucratic bullshit of civil service and all the rest of that crap. Get you nuts when you're already nuts, right? They gave me an aptitude test 5 times. I came out 5 different things, okay? You know. They didn't know what to do with me. I didn't know what to do with me, you know. I came out a forest ranger, a classical pianist, a social worker, a psychologist, and something else. And I kept trying to tell this chick that was my counselor. I said, if you put the pianist in the forest, we got a problem, right? Finally, I got an idea. I don't know where it came from. I went in. I said to her, I said, hey, you know what? I said, I'd like to try and be a writer. This was in December. This was 6 months after I broke my back, and she almost fell out of her wheelchair laughing. She thought that was so funny, okay? Because I don't have an education. I've failed English ever since the fourth grade, and I'm a phonetic speller. I mean, she knew. She'd seen my paperwork. She knew everything there was about me. She thought it was hysterical. They were so goddamn glad to get me off her caseload, they paid for a correspondence course, okay? First thing I submitted to a studio, they botched. They botched. Came as a result of breaking my back, okay? 12 years later, I still write for a living. I'm very successful in what I do. I'm